Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
We cannot return to might is right. Those were the words of Canada's outgoing Prime Minister Justin Trudeau addressing a summit of leaders in Kyiv in the past hour, marking the third anniversary of Russia's invasion. Ukraine's President Zelensky earlier hailed 3 years of resistance and 3 years of absolute heroism of Ukrainians. But as Washington pivots from Kyiv to Moscow and President Trump eyes up Ukraine's mineral resources, the map of Europe looks less certain than at any time since the fall of the Berlin Wall. Well, to discuss all of this, we're joined from Kyiv by BBC's Ukraine correspondent James Waterhouse, from Brussels by Associate Editor at Politico Suzanne Lynch, and from Washington by Chief Correspondent with Feature Story News, Simon Marks. And we're going to start with you, James, in Ukraine. I mean, when the war began, there were some analysts who feared that Ukraine could collapse within 3 weeks. They've held out now for 3 years. But holding out is hard. It's exhausting. It has cost many lives and livelihoods. How would you say Ukrainians are on this 3-year anniversary?
I think you're right. I think the yearnings for peace cannot be doubted because of the realities of war. No nation can fight indefinitely, not least in a war of attrition against a foe the size of Russia. But it is the terms of that peace which is increasingly tainting that desire, because if Ukraine, and we're hearing this over and over, if it doesn't achieve a significant security guarantee, be it a meaningful troop presence by its Western allies in the future, then there is the very real chance that Russia will remain on a war footing, maintain a sizable military presence on the territory it's occupied, and simply have another go down the line. And so, in the words of one soldier, you know, with the geopolitics affecting morale, no doubt, he said, a ceasefire does not mean peace. And that is the real pitfall, as Ukraine sees it, when you hear about Donald Trump's vision of peace.
Now, we were hearing there in the bulletin about this meeting which is being hosted by President Zelensky and attended by European leaders. And I see in the last few minutes that the Spanish Prime Minister has announced a new €1 billion aid package for Ukraine. We also have the French President Macron saying, I will go. We know he's going to Washington this week. He says, I will go and I will present peace proposals to Donald Trump to counteract what Trump and America is trying to do. That support now from Europe is more important than ever before, isn't it?
It absolutely is, but it's still a question of what Europe can provide and whether Europe can unite. Now, Emmanuel Macron, Keir Starmer of the UK, they are both set to meet Donald Trump this week, and they are hoping that presenting a plan, be it specific troop numbers, specific pledges on defence spending, might just bring him back to the table. Because this consensus is that European allies need America as a military safety net if fighting was to break out. But the feeling here, the tone here, is if looking inward, there's no glossing over of America's upending of its foreign policy and aligning with Russia. There is now a real striving to work out where to go from here. And on, you know, if America was to present Ukraine with a ceasefire, it saw as unacceptable, be it with the selling of its natural minerals or otherwise, then you really get the impression that President Zelensky would turn it down. And if he did, and he was forced to fight this war in a more isolated fashion, and Europe can't step up, then these will have seismic consequences for the security of the region and the future of Ukraine.
Now, people will have heard or may have heard over the weekend President Zelensky offering to step down if it would deliver a secure peace or grant Ukraine membership of NATO. Was that a serious offer, or was he about sending a message there?
I think it was because if you look at what Washington's been saying, I mean, Donald Trump essentially parroting the Kremlin attack line that President Zelensky was an illegitimate leader because elections had legally been postponed. And he was asked yesterday, a very somber yet business-like anniversary press conference, he was asked, well, would you consider your position? And he said, yeah, absolutely. If it meant peace, if it meant NATO membership, then I would step aside, have ambitions to stay in the job for decades, he said. And on Donald Trump's labelling of him as a dictator, he said, look, you know, these are just words, they don't offend me. If I was a dictator, I think I would be offended. That drew a bit of a laugh. But it's an extraordinary U-turn where I remember on the first year anniversary, we had Joe Biden visit. It was about how best the West could unite around Ukraine. Now it was about whether Europe could unite around Ukraine in the face of Russian aggression. There are the likes of Poland that would like him to engage calmly and constructively with Donald Trump. But he was frank. It really does appear that their relationship has turned personal rather than political. Mm-hmm. And there is a big question mark over whether that can be turned around and how European allies would respond to that.
And what are people saying about this demand from Donald Trump that Ukraine pay in terms of mineral resources for military aid already given over the last 3 years?
Well, America is calling it a transaction for peace. And there are people here that think it amounts to extortion. Now, there are a whole host of conflicting reports over to what extent a deal is going to be agreed. But at the moment, it looks increasingly polarizing. You've got America demanding access to $500 billion worth of Ukraine's natural minerals. That was the figure it produced. And it wants payment for the aid it has given to date and payment for the aid it'll give in the future. President Zelensky has said, I'm not going to sell my state. You know, what was given to us by America in the past was a grant. It was not a loan. And he made the comparison. He said, when America gives a military aid to the likes of Israel in the Middle East, does it then demand a 100% markup as a payment off the back of that? No. So how is Ukraine different, he is arguing? It may well be that an agreement can be reached as America continues this transactional approach, in that it would give an interest for America to defend. But in equal measure, I would not be surprised if he turned it down. And you wonder what that would mean for the course of this war.
So what happens now, I mean, with this situation with the States, when we look at the weaponry available to Ukraine? Do we know how long their existing stockpiles will last? And will there be a gap? And if so, surely that's a terrible vista for Ukrainians, particularly those who are on the front lines.
Yeah, we're seeing a Joe Biden legacy effect here. You know, before he left office, there were a flurry of American diplomats here getting agreements over the line. So we will still see ammunition, armored vehicles, air defense units still continuing to arrive. I spoke to one head of a charity, one of the biggest weapons providers to troops in Ukraine since 2014. And he said, look, Ukraine could keep fighting for a year. Beyond that, who knows? Because Europe has acknowledged it can't plug the gap. It missed every ammunition manufacturing target it set over the past couple of years in terms of artillery shells. Now, Europe together has contributed just as much, if not more, than America. But it's America in terms of lethal aid, because of the speed and scale it can make stuff for Ukraine to fight with. That is still the pivotal difference. And that is why we're seeing Europe still calling for America to be there just in case. So that it may well compel Ukraine to concede and agree to a pause, no matter how unpalatable the conditions may be, if Donald Trump compels them. But this is a country that has known nothing else other than fighting back. It still sees this war as existential. Of course there are yearnings for peace. Of course people have had enough of the death and destruction. But it is, we sort of are fast approaching a diplomatic bottleneck over what course Ukraine chooses to take and what America decides to offer.
James Waterhouse in Ukraine, thank you very much. Let's turn to Suzanne Lynch now in Brussels. Suzanne, we mentioned this senior delegation of EU leaders are in Kyiv. There's an announcement of further aid. And we know this country, Ireland, we're donating air defences. What else is on the table today at that meeting?
Yeah, so a number of EU commissioners, in fact, most of the European Commission under Ursula von der Leyen are in Kyiv, as well as about a dozen or so European leaders like Pedro Sanchez, who you mentioned there, the Spanish Prime Minister. And already we've been hearing kind of a trickle of news coming from Kyiv about what each country is planning to offer. Now, meanwhile, here in Brussels, foreign ministers are meeting, including the Taoiseach Simon Harris. And what they're doing mainly is that they're signing off on the latest sanctions package against Russia that was agreed by diplomats last week. And today, now, foreign ministers have just signed off on that. In one sense, this is a difficulty, though, for Europe, because even as they're moving forward with further sanctions against Russia, At the same time, the United States is talking about loosening sanctions against Russia. So this is another aspect now of this growing rift we're seeing between Washington and Europe on sanctions. You know, how effective will sanctions be if the US decides to in some way unravel them? How will the European economy cope if the US goes back into Russia and leaves Europe still with its own sanctions? So it's important for Europe to keep going with these sanctions in terms of giving that support to Ukraine. But as I say there, that break with America is a concern. But we also expect preliminary discussions today about what further aid, be it military help or further financing, Europe can give to Ukraine. As you've just been discussing there, it's more important than ever for Ukraine with the rhetoric that's coming from the Trump administration.
And also, I would imagine, how to deal with this issue, you know, the fact that Russia and the United States are having negotiations excluding Brussels, excluding Ukraine, excluding the UK. Now, President Macron is heading over this week to Washington. He says he has his own plan, but the fear is he'll be ignored. I mean, how does the EU get around that table?
Yeah, you're absolutely right in that at the moment, what Donald Trump has done is essentially begin negotiations over the heads of Ukraine and Europe. Europe is not at the table. That's the reality. So I think this week of diplomacy where Macron...
We lost
Trump. It's really crucial.
Sorry, Suzanne, your line dipped there, but you're back. So carry on.
Yes. So just making the point that this, because Europe is away from these discussions, this week of diplomacy is crucial. So we have Emmanuel Macron, we expect to hear from him, and Donald Trump later on today, and then Keir Starmer later in the week. So I think their interventions here, their visits to the White House this week, are crucial. And I think they're going to be looking for some kind of a promise from the United States that they will be part of some kind of peacekeeping troop in Ukraine, some part of a security guarantee. So I think you're going to see some very kind of clever diplomacy where these two leaders are going to be trying to convey to Donald Trump, you know, maybe the importance of his legacy. Does he really want to stand over a peace agreement that might unravel? You know, so I think we're seeing a lot of discussions happening now that this is a real moment where they need to communicate to the United States the importance of its role in what happens next in Ukraine. There's also a G7 meeting later today, basically to mark the third anniversary of the war today. So we'll see some top European leaders on that meeting, as well as Trump, of course.
We know, of course, Ukraine wants to be part of the EU. I mean, that's one way that the EU could leverage its position against the United States by speeding up that process. Is that possible?
Well, it is. I mean, the accession process to join the EU is a long one. And, you know, Ukraine has to tick a lot of boxes. We saw last year a little bit of disquiet in countries like Poland about the huge number of potential imports of agriculture that would come into the EU if Ukraine was to join. But look, I think people want Ukraine to join the EU, but I think for Ukraine, it's more important the path to NATO membership at the moment, part of that military alliance, which, of course, the US has poured cold water on. But yes, I think the plan is still very much a commitment for Ukraine to join the EU, but that is not going to happen in the next year or so, for example. So I think the immediate challenges are first and foremost in Ukraine's mind.
Suzanne, thank you very much for joining us from Brussels. We're also joined, as I said, from Washington by Simon Marks now. Simon, there are reports over the weekend that some of Donald Trump's own appointees now are pushing back against Elon Musk and his attempts to fire people who he believes are not doing very much work. But in the context of what's happening with Russia, is there any indication that there is pushback against this new America-Russia alliance that we see forming?
Well, Claire, there's certainly no indication of any pushback from within Donald Trump's cabinet towards all of this. And indeed, Donald Trump's first cabinet meeting will be held later this week. And I suspect we will see a completely united tableau sitting around the cabinet table. But pushback is coming from some more traditional Republicans up on Capitol Hill, including people like Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, of course, a Trump whisperer as well. well as being a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He has spoken himself to Zelensky in the last few days and indicated that he still believes that the United States should stand shoulder to shoulder with Kyiv and was going to go off and see how much influence he could bring to bear on the American president. But equally, the Trump administration has been very clear towards those few rebels up on Capitol Hill that are pushing Donald Trump to adopt a more orthodox American line, that he's not going to be pushed around by anyone. And I think that's really because, as we've seen, really over just the last, 10 or 12 days, for Donald Trump, this is all about one outcome. It's about the money. It's about the United States essentially taking control of these extremely valuable minerals that lie beneath Ukrainian soil for generations to come without, in the first draft of the agreement, even providing security guarantees for the country. But on the flip side of the coin, it's also about giving Vladimir Putin exactly what he wants and what Donald Trump wants, which is a geopolitical and burgeoning economic relationship with Russia. And both of those things, in Donald Trump's mind and the minds of members of his inner circle, absolutely are primary, and everything else is taking a backseat.
Mm-hmm. So it's all about that deal, regardless of the consequences, almost.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, we will, I suspect, never fully understand the nature of Donald Trump's relationship with Vladimir Putin. It is astonishing to foreign policy veterans in Washington, D.C., that the American president not only has made this 180, I mean, under normal circumstances, we'd be seeing an American president, Joe Biden, in Kyiv today with European leaders. We've not yet seen any statement from the White House about the anniversary when it comes. I suspect it will describe what Donald Trump always refers to as a ridiculous war, and will say that only Donald Trump can bring it to an end, a phrase that Marco Rubio, Steve Witkoff, and Mike Waltz, his envoys who went to Riyadh to meet with Russian officials, were using like a mantra in their post-discussion press conferences. So it is evident already that Donald Trump has given Vladimir Putin so much of what he wants. No NATO membership for Ukraine. He's ruled that out. No particular interest in emphasizing security guarantees for Ukraine, a seat at the table at the G7 for Russia, and this talk about revived geopolitical and economic relations between Moscow and Washington, which puts the United States in an extraordinary position. It's pre-gamed the outcome of these peace negotiations without even bringing the Europeans and the Ukrainians themselves to the table. And into that maelstrom, the French President Emmanuel Macron and the UK's Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer will walk later this week at a time when Donald Trump is expressing absolute disdain for the European Union and for what I think he would consider its woke aims and ambitions regarding Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. And now we have, as I mentioned earlier, the French President heading over saying he has his own proposal to put to Donald Trump. We'll have Keir Starmer, the UK Prime Minister, there as well this week. Simon, how do you expect that they are likely to be received, in particular their appeals on behalf of Ukraine?
Look, I think it's going to be very difficult. There's no doubt about that. And there are some veteran sort of foreign policy analysts here who say that actually the Europeans should be staying in Europe and kind of demanding that Donald Trump travels the Atlantic to meet them there. But at the end of the day, he's completely transactional, and this is largely going to come down to the money. If the European leaders are able to pierce the misinformation, the disinformation that Donald Trump has expressed in the last few days. In his telling, sometimes America has spent $350 billion supporting Ukraine. Sometimes America has spent $500 billion supporting Ukraine. In fact, the real number is much closer to $100 billion. But he's fixated on getting this money back in some form, but never entertains the idea that any of it should come from the $300 billion of Russian assets that the Europeans have frozen. So whether he's open to new thinking about all of this, I think, is unclear. We do know that there is one possible area for leverage, and that came from the president's national security advisor, Mike Waltz, who said a few days ago that this notion of European nations and others providing peacekeepers with a US backstop, Sir Keir Starmer even suggesting that UK troops he would be willing to put on the ground between the two countries to try and keep the peace, provided there was a US backstop. Mike Waltz indicated that that was an interesting idea and something that the Americans wanted to explore. So at least there is the possibility of having a conversation about that. But at the end of the day, it is all going to come down to the money and to prioritizing Donald Trump's relationship with Vladimir Putin against the aggrieved party in this conflict, Volodymyr Zelensky.
Okay, Simon, I see in the last few minutes Elon Musk has been on Twitter again, or X as he ever off it, but he says that people who ignored President Trump's executive order to return to work, so these are the people who've been working from home, have now received over a month's warning. Starting this week, those who still failed to return to the office will be placed on administrative leave. And I mentioned there at the beginning of our conversation that there is some pushback coming now, isn't there, from those who are leading some of these federal organizations, saying we will decide who stays or who goes, we will decide what work is valuable and what isn't. So that's a bit of a turn in this whole DOGE project and Elon Musk's influence.
Yes, and it was interesting the way the weekend played out, Claire, because Donald Trump, as you know, put out a posting on his social media platform on Saturday morning saying that he wanted Elon Musk to get even more aggressive towards the federal workforce. That led then to Elon Musk becoming more aggressive towards the federal workforce and putting out that email demanding that 3 million federal government workers send him an email detailing the five things they accomplished at work last week. Some cabinet chiefs and senior figures in the Trump administration said, you don't have to do that to their workers. For example, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. told the Health and Human Services Department that their employees didn't need to respond to the email. Kash Patel at the FBI did the same thing. But Pam Bondi, the Attorney General, told Department of Justice employees that they did need to respond to the email. So there's an enormous degree of chaos around all of this. And regarding that latest threat by Elon Musk, look, there's no question that this push to get people back into the office is publicly popular, and it frankly beggars belief that Joe Biden never did it himself when he was president of the United States. But whether Elon Musk is now overstepping his bounds will all depend on the attitude that President Trump takes to all of this. There are some people wondering if this was a bit of a trap that Donald Trump created for Elon Musk to fall into, which might begin the process of Elon Musk's departure from his inner circle. But we've heard so many whispers in the past about tensions and stresses between the two men. And then you look up and you see them sitting side by side in an interview with Sean Hannity telling everybody how much they love each other. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure yet where this all heads.
But for regular workers, you know, who are relying on those jobs to put food on the table and pay the mortgage, it's an awful time, Simon, isn't it? Not knowing whether your job's going to exist in a week.
I cannot emphasize enough how much trauma and stress Elon Musk's handling of this situation and Donald Trump's handling of this situation has created in hundreds of thousands of American families. And remember that the trauma was created by design. The new head of the Office of Management and Budget, Russell Vogt, said back in 2023 that the plan was to make life so miserable for federal government workers, whom he said should wake up in the morning feeling like villains, feeling like they didn't want to go to work. This was all part of the plan. And to see Elon Musk on Thursday night prancing about the stage at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, brandishing a chainsaw and quite literally celebrating the crisis that he has sparked in hundreds of thousands of families all over the country simply because they happen to be civil servants on the public government workforce, is simply an example of the cruelty that seems to go hand in hand with many of the orders that Donald Trump signs and the executive actions that his de facto Prime Minister Elon Musk then enforces.
It's extraordinary. Simon, thank you once again for being with us. Simon Marks there joining us from Washington. Coming up next on the programme, could ear pods help your hearing? Plus, what are we in store for with our own presidential election?
Get in touch on WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32.